As I went looking for definitions of masculinity and what the definition coming to from the church was, and I should put as a footnote, I do very much appreciate, Neil, the new emphasis on masculinity in the church and how masculinity and spirituality are no longer at odds with one another. And as I like to say, the smell of bacon coming from the church is a very positive thing. But what I noticed and observed was that within these books, there are no real specific chapters on Jesus Christ as the example of masculinity. And what you end up receiving are lessons from the life of David and lessons from the life of Moses and lessons from the life of Joshua and lessons from the life of Joseph. And biblically, all of those people point to Jesus. There are arrows that point to the need for Jesus Christ. Each one of those men have one thing in common, and that is that they needed Christ too, and they just happened to be used in the redemptive history of things to bring that to pass. And so that's a little disturbing, because what we end up doing, I think, is having a definition of masculinity that kind of doesn't really exist and might even be the wrong question. You know, if you pattern yourself after David, King David, and say this is masculinity, you run into some really significant issues, because in reality, if all have sinned and all fall short of the glory of God, that includes everybody except Christ, which includes David. And as I like to point out, David, I have some friends that are better than David, in the sense that if David committed adultery, fathered an illegitimate child, and then tried to cover it up through murder, I have friends that have never done that. The point being, not to diminish David's role in the biblical history and the messianic realities that are there, but why, is the question is being begged here, why aren't we focusing on Christ? And would Christ himself fit our kind of stereotype within Christianity about this? I don't think we should be moralizing the stories of David and Joshua and Joseph and saying that's what masculinity is, because those men are just as fallen as we are. I think we need to ask another question, which is, when Christianity and the gospel invade a man's life, what does that look like? And that's a much different question. So I think, in a sense, masculinity is a self-evident reality. I think the Bible doesn't actually define what masculinity is, because it assumes that we would understand it and we would know it. And I think the Bible is begging a bigger question, which is, when grace invades a man's life, what does it look like? And I think if you look at the New Testament, and it talks about the male's role to the female in marriage and the husband to the wife and to the children, it's always in the context of the cross. So ultimately, what I think masculinity looks like from the biblical and Christian perspective is servant and servanthood. And I mean in the most radical ways. And that's not weakness. And that doesn't exclude the other elements of masculinity that we enjoy. We shouldn't be afraid to be men in the church. But at the same time, if masculinity comes down to courage, and if it comes down to strength of character, and if it comes down to diligence, and if it comes down to commitment, and it comes down to consistency, then we have to admit that those traits are also the things that must be necessary in Islamic terrorist, meaning that there's nothing necessarily Christian about them. And I know that's odd to hear, but it's true. So ours has to go farther, and I think what we need to understand is that we're talking about a cross-centered, self-sacrificing spirit that is radically different and transcends all those things. It may include them, but it's not ultimately defined by them. And as I try to point out in the book, some of the most masculine men I have ever met are not field dressing deer, and they don't know how to bore the cylinders on a V8. They have pocket protectors and plaid shirts, and they're very common, but they are extraordinarily self-sacrificingly consistent and broken-hearted worshipers of Christ Jesus. And when we adapt the world's definition and lay it over the church's, I think we make a huge mistake, because what we're looking for is something that transcends those things in the spirit of Christ. So a man who is self-restrained and sacrifices his own wants and desires for his wife is a very masculine man. It's not a weakness. In fact, if I ask a man, do you love your wife? And they say, yes, of course. And then I turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and I say, but let me ask you a deeper question. Do you include your wife in on decisions you make? Because the Bible says, considers others more important than themselves, takes others into consideration. That raises the definition of masculinity and love. So we're talking about a love towards those we serve as men, which includes any character within masculinity. The guy that wears the wife beater t-shirt and is up under the hood of the 67 Mustang, and the guy who is really good at codes and computers. So the book itself is arguing even against, Neil, the church's definition, the current definition of masculinity. And it's my personal opinion that maybe the pendulum swung too far the other direction in a reaction to kind of the androgynous spirituality that's been offered by the church for so many years. And again, I love bacon and the smell of it coming from the church, but when Jesus himself is not included in our literature, which is trying to define masculinity, in my humble opinion, and you can read the book and come away with your own conclusions, and I think that there's something really wrong with that.
I was interested, you made a mention a phrase here early on talking about what your sons are thinking. And I know you have two boys now. I'm wondering, what, as you've talked with them and talked with other men, and say, what are boys thinking? And what do they maybe want to hear most from dad? Or what are the words that dad can say? Or is it more about just the way he lives that's going to answer those questions that what sons are wondering about?
Well, it's a little bit of both what he says and how he lives combined, guidance and example. But I can tell you exactly what adolescent boys are thinking. They're thinking that they're crazy, and they're thinking that they have to go through this alone. And that's kind of typically the reaction. I mean, if you just think about the amount of time that we spend teaching our sons how to ride a bike, or we spend teaching our sons how to throw a curveball, or we teach our sons about how to camp, and we put a lot of attention on certain things, and we want to be involved in their lives. But when it comes to something like self-awareness or sexuality, we give no information to our kids at all, and our sons in particular. And so there's this weird phenomenon that, you know, puberty and adolescence is about the most obvious heads up of all time for parents, and we do very little in discipling our children and just warning them about the various physiological, emotional, relational, and social changes that are coming their way. And so in the absence of information, we force our sons to navigate this landmine-filled region of their life by themselves. And so they end up thinking that they're failing here, and that they're disappointing their parents, and that they're crazy, and that these struggles that they're having are wrong. And I think that are unique to them. And maybe the message coming from the church that, you know, you're not supposed to have feelings about girls and you're not supposed to be concerned about sex puts them in a very weird spot. So I know for a fact that these young men really think that they're alone and they are on their own and that they're completely insane, because overnight these radical changes come into their life. I can tell you what they want to hear as well. And this is where I think fathers maybe outpunt their coverage a little bit and think it's a little more difficult than it actually is. They want to know two things. And if you get this down, I think your relationship with your sons in particular will blossom, which might not be the most masculine way to describe that. But the first thing they want to hear is, I love you unconditionally. I mean, of all the questions, all the answers that came back to, you know, what do you wish your father would have told you from my survey, love was the number one thing. Like, I love you. I know you're going to struggle. You're going to mess up. You're going to blow it. You're going to make mistakes, but your Father loves you. And my correction and my commendation are a part of that. And I think fathers misunderstand that their affection for their sons, the good and the bad, is a heads-up display for life that they need desperately, and they want it. They want that. And there's a difference, and this is just an observation, but there's a difference between the man whose father told him, I'm proud of you and I love you on a regular basis, and the man who grows up who didn't have a father that did that. The one who received it has a mooring in his life. So, number one, what they want to hear is, I love you. And then secondly, what they want to hear is counsel and really availability. That there's a difference between being present as a father and being engaged as a father, studying your children. And part of our role as a father is to observe their life and to point out areas of struggle, which are natural to them, that they're going to deal with when they have their first job, when they get married, when they get older, whether it be materialism or selfishness or laziness. A father's role is to speak in and kind of, as I've described it, Neil, you kind of, like a bike, you run beside their life as far as you can until they have it and they take it on their own. So what do they want to hear? I love you. And they want to know that you're available and you have counsel and you're ready. And the men who kind of wait until their sons are 15, 16, 17 to start taking those reins will often find some pushback coming from the son. It looks like rebellion, but often it's confusion because the father hasn't been there. I mean, when people ask me, like, when do you know when it's proper to talk to your son about sex? I have two answers. Number one, it's usually much earlier than you think. And number two, it's not one conversation. It's multiple conversations. And it's not just about sexuality. It's about the things that make sex make sense. So sons think they're crazy, and they need their fathers to tell them that they're not, that their insanity is normal and true for all men.